Well, a very good afternoon and very warm welcome to the Institute of Healthcare Engineering and Estate Management West Midlands Branch Annual General Meeting. My name's Chris Needham. I'm sorry to disappoint those of you that were expecting to see Mr. Wade here today, but unfortunately Phil has to attend a funeral, so I've agreed to oversee proceedings for the time being. So this afternoon, we're going to work through the annual general meeting agenda. And then following that, when we've been through the formalities, we'll move on to a group discussion, or more of a conversation, with a number of our committee members and members, where we'll be talking about the relevant aspects and learning around COVID-19 and some of the experiences and some of the, I guess, the challenges that were experienced during that time. So there'll be an opportunity to ask questions as we go through. It's an interactive event, so I would encourage you to do just that, and let's hope that we can all learn from each other. So without any further ado, Gemma, could I ask you to put up the agenda on the screen? And we'll start with any apologies. I wonder, Tom, have we received any apologies or from anybody in the audience?
I've received no apologies via the email for anybody at a moment.
Okay, thank you very much. So no apologies have been registered. And if we could turn our attention to the minutes of the last annual general meeting, which hopefully Gemma will put on the screen for us. Hopefully those of you on the call have already had an opportunity to have a look through those minutes. And what I seek to do is just confirm for accuracy, and then we'll accept them formally. So this is page one, page two, not a great deal of content on there. So for those that were in attendance, page two. And if we move through to three, please, Gemma. In terms of accuracy, are we content that they're an accurate record of the conversation at the last AGM, given that it was 12 months ago in fairness? So if there's no objections, if you want to object, please put your hand up in the chat. And Gemma will spot you instantly and let us know. Okay, so we'll accept the minutes of the last AGM and we'll move on to any matters arising. So are there any matters arising from the last meeting that anybody wishes to raise?
I've received no matters arising, Chris, from the last meeting.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. Anybody on the call with any matters arising from the minutes? Nope. Okay. Brilliant. Okay. So with that being the case, then I'll move on, if I may, we'll accept the meeting, the minutes. We'll note that there were no matters arising from those minutes, and we'll move on to the Secretary's report, please, Tom.
Okay, thanks, Chris. I'll keep my report as brief as possible, as I know Phil has got a lot of information in his report next. Firstly, I would like to thank our engineering community for the exceptional work that has been done in support of each other, both technically and emotionally, through COVID. Without doubt, we've been challenged from all directions, and without doubt, our response has been first class. Since the last AGM, our normal branch activity has changed, and we've embraced new technology to meet, and we've started the new electronic means of meeting and arranging technical papers. This is both supported by IEM head office, and now we have such things as our own branch web page, which is under development, and new contact email addresses for both the branch chair, secretary and treasurer, all of which are available from the IEM website. We've also started a newsletter, all of which aim to improve communication to our members, which have been supported by recent membership survey, which I know will be detailed later. We've had three nominations for new branch officers this year, which we'll come on to again later. And I welcome people to get in touch with the committee. Ideas for papers or items of interest are always welcomed. But if you're not sure about anything iron related, please do not hesitate to get in touch. Going forward, we have lots of ideas for technical papers and new topics such as mental health, and information about these events will be circulated shortly to the branch. That's all I wanted to address at the moment, Chris, because I know there's a lot coming in the next section.
Thank you very much, Tom. And as any good Hollywood event would say, unfortunately, our next artist can't be with us, but we have our chairman's report, and he's recorded a message, very kindly recorded a message. And I think, Gemma, if we can access that would be great. We can start, we can hear from Phil. Super. Well, thank you very much for that, Phil. We really appreciate it. And I think I'd like to formally, for the minutes, record my thanks and that of the committee for your leadership, your enthusiasm, and the time that you've dedicated to the first 12 months of your tenure. And I think we should congratulate you on what's been a really difficult year, a challenging year. So thank you very much. We very much appreciate your input and all of your efforts in terms of leading the branch. So let's move on with the next item in terms of branch officers. I think we can put the list of the committee members up, if that's all right. So what I propose to do with this list is, clearly the first 10 names on that list are existing committee members. My proposal is that unless there are any objections to those people continuing as committee members, we'll accept the nominations as read. And then we'll move on to the other nominations for the new members, if that's acceptable. So just in terms of the existing committee members then, could I just, at the risk of anybody making an objection, could I just ask if anybody has any objections to those people continuing in those posts as part of the committee to raise your hand? I'm hoping Gemma's going to confirm that we don't have anybody raising an objection.
No objections, right. Just a slight name adjustment for Eleanor Graham, from Eleanor Matthews to Eleanor Graham.
Thank you very much. A little panic stricken then when the chat icon started flashing the moment I said that. So thank you for the clarification, Gemma. That's very helpful. So in terms of new members, we have three proposals today. We have Jess Taylor, Andy Vernon and Steve Lawley. So let's start with Steve. Could we have a proposal, please, for Steve to become a member of the committee?
I'll propose it, Chris.
Thank you, Tom. And a seconder?
I'll do that, Chris.
Sorry, Gemma, whoever spoke that, I missed that. We have a seconder. Yes? Just to confirm, I think you said yes. Thank you very much. Jess Taylor, could we have a proposal, please, for Jess?
Yeah, hi, Chris. It's Mark Williams here. Yeah, I propose Jess.
Thank you, Mark. Anybody to second Jess, please?
I'll second Jess, Chris.
Okay. Thank you, Tom. And Andy Vernon, proposal for Andy, please. Ideally,
yeah. Hi, it's Mark. Yes, it's Mark here. Yeah, I'll propose Andy.
And to second.
It's Claire here. I'm happy to second Andy.
Thank you very much, Claire. So welcome, Jess and Andy and Steve, to the committee. We're very happy to have you on board. And let's hope that we have some very interesting and fruitful meetings in the coming months. Thank you very much. So that, in terms of branch officers, concludes the main business, the formal business of the AGM. So it just remains for me to ask from our attendees today, if we have any other business that we'd like to consider at this time. Anything in chat, Gemma?
Nothing coming through at the moment.
Okay. Well, if there is no other business, I will formally close the AGM. Thank you very much for your participation. And now I'm going to hand over to Mark Williams, and we're going to engage in a facilitated discussion around the last 12 months and the lessons that we've learned from them. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. And we've got everybody on camera, everybody on microphone. This is the point where I felt I wish I was Phil, really, and I did a recorded message, actually, so we hadn't got to do this. We could have edited and then got it all particularly right. But So thank you for joining this. This is, you have to bear with us, we're not all scripted actors and there's no script that we're reading from, and this isn't highly polished, but this is meant to be an informal discussion that you may find some of the parts interesting in. Just to do some introductions, my name is Mark Williams. I run a business called Boardroom Knowledge Limited. I'm also a council member, IHEAM National Council, and also I'm on the IHEAM West Midlands Committee. So that's my involvement with IHEAM. So let me just introduce you, and I'll ask them to say who they are. But should we do ladies first? Should we go to Claire first? Where are you from, Claire?
Hi, Claire Hennessy, Director of Estates and Facilities for Birmingham Community Healthcare Foundation Trust.
Thanks, Claire. And to Andy.
Hi, everybody. Andy Vernon, Sector Director for Healthcare for Hawley Consultancy within Birmingham.
Thank you. And Tom?
I'm the Secretary of West Midland Branch, and I'm the Head of Estates for Wolverhampton NHS Trust.
Yeah, thank you, Tom. Thanks, Andy, and thanks, Kay. We were going to have Kevin Reynolds on the call, but I think he's, obviously with the demands of the job he has at the moment, he's been called to go elsewhere, really. As Phil was suggesting on his VT, I think they call them, is that life has changed, really, and we do, doing this online is a new challenge, and I think things like Zoom, I thought, was an isolation, and furlough was something to do with horse racing. So we've learned a lot of new terms in the last sort of 12 months. But what has been, we've never lived through a pandemic like this before. And it's interesting, when that sort of happened just over a year ago, I was quite fortunate, really. I was able to be, in the eye of the storm, I was okay to sort of go in, stay at home, enjoy the sunshine and watch a lot of Netflix and eat a lot of biscuit. For you guys, you were really in the sort of eye of the storm. I mean, Claire, just kicking us off, how scary was that at that time? When we were all retreating, your family must have been scared, you must have been scared, you were scared for your staff. Well, not scared, it's not the right word, but concerned. How did you feel?
I think at the start, nobody really knew enough about anything to really feel too scared at the start of it. I think it was as things started to escalate, and obviously the numbers increased of hospital admissions, and for us, particularly in the community, we were called to find extra bed capacity, etc., to support the acute. Then it became a lot more real. But I think Tom probably had that reality check a lot quicker than we did. Our involvement was very much from that support service in the community. And also once we started the swabbing and those kind of things, and now later the vaccine centres. But Tom, you were pretty much in the heart of the real COVID crisis.
Yeah, I think Wolverhampton was one of the initial hotspots in the country, and we saw quite an influx of COVID patients quite quickly. And certainly one of the biggest challenges we saw initially was oxygen demand and trying to manage that demand. And certainly on a clinical side, demand patients and where patients were accommodated. Obviously, it was probably a situation where clinically a patient could be clear of COVID, and then they could develop COVID symptoms while on a ward, which might mean you need to create red areas or segregate areas. And there's certainly a lot of that happening as well. It's definitely is quite challenging, and it is quite a scary prospect initially when COVID kicked off, because it was an unknown. It's quite easy now to look back and think about what we could have done and things we did do, and analyse what we did do. But when you were faced with it initially, we didn't know exactly what was going to happen and the numbers involved.
And it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because, not being experienced a pandemic like this before, there was no HTM for COVID to reach for, was there as such? And there's no guidebook apart from, and just the challenges with that. And Andy, you and I had a conversation from I won't say a lonely hotel room in London, but you went off to do the Nightingale wards in London, didn't see your family for quite a while, What was that experience like?
Mark, I think, yes, I invited you virtually with a group of other people into a hotel bedroom one morning, didn't I? So I got seconded to go down to XL Nightingale probably one year ago this week, really. It was a real baptism. As you've said, no standards in place, really flying by the seat of our pants and trying to get some kind of order in what was just a, you know, 2 months of complete chaos. And we were working in a facility that wasn't really the best of facilities to try and convert into a healthcare facility, of course. A big exhibition hall isn't easily adapted, but healthcare estates, healthcare engineers, construction industry, frontline sort of healthcare workers and the armed forces just collaborated and managed to come up with a really, really great solution. And I think that's real testament to us all, really, isn't it? As a sector, everybody that works in it. And that was a real great learning. And I did come home. I had to come back and get some shirts and sort of underwear and then sort of hightail it back down the motorway every 2 weeks. But it was a real detachment from the family. But ultimately, you're doing something really worthwhile.
And how did you, because, you know, normally, you know, and you're a good consultant, you work in a good consultants team, to build that so many beds, is, you know, normally takes you a couple of years, doesn't it? How did you do it so quick? And what was the lessons learned as part of that?
Yeah, I think that clearly not having standards was probably, it freed up a fair amount of thinking, but it also needed the end game determined some of the inputs that was required. So that sort of pushed people towards a more modular approach to some of the thinking. So if we needed lightweight structures in a temporary facility, we had to think, we had to be agile, and the products that we were using had to come from agile sources as well. But along the way, we picked up some sort of core sort of things that sort of threw the team from one sort of one area to another area. There was a huge demand on electrical services, and we thought bear hugger patient blankets would starve the electricity demand. Actually, what we found in the end was the patients were arriving very high fevers, and we needed to cool the building. So there was no need for bear huggers, but what we needed to do was turn an ITU facility that we would normally have at 23 degrees down to 19 degrees and below. We'd never operated in those areas. And so we were all really learning from first sort of experiences.
That's brilliant. I mean, and you just spoiled my next question, really, because I was going to ask you about the bear hugging blanket. So thanks for that. I must go back to Phil's video link, the nice bit of static branding in that, I thought, as well. Subtly done, I thought, subtly done. Claire, you know, when you started switching stuff back on, you know, and there was, I don't know, in the sort of summertime when things come back, you know, places like, for you in the community, like dental must have been a real challenge, mustn't it, you know?
It still is. So dental was a challenge because of AGPs. So what we were finding was, where we had open bay dental surgeries, like at our Hunt Dental Hospital, because of the AGP situation, there was a risk with these open bays of how the airflow would obviously transgress across that bay. So initially we were saying, like, closed bays only, negative pressure. And then we were having to go out to our community dental sites to see how they were working, what their ventilation systems were doing, and also how the vacuum systems were operating, because a lot of them are small little compressors underneath a bench somewhere, and where they were discharging to, did they have HEPAs fitted to them? So dental on the whole, and again, looking at HGMs, the HM ventilation didn't help us at all. We didn't know what air changes we were looking for. We didn't know whether it had to be negative. We obviously, for our own intelligence, thought, well, positive can't be good because you're going to be pushing it into adjacent rooms. But then, was balanced okay? Could you just have, I mean, a lot of the community dental only have a window. They don't even have any ventilation as such. So that's been a real huge learning curve for all of us with regards to the dental services and AGPs in particular, even so far as when schools went back and how we could support our specialist school nurses with some of the patients that they support in schools. So yeah, it's been a really challenging area, ventilation as a whole.
Thanks for that. And I'm glad you use the word challenging, because when I was sat at home and I came in from the sunshine and I did watch Netflix, I did watch Back to the Future 1, 2 and 3. And I was thinking really with that, that sort of a link really. I don't want you to think you had it difficult. I had it difficult. You know, they don't watch themselves, those programs, don't. But, you know, Tom, if we were getting in my DeLorean and going back to the future and you were going back to last year, you know, what would you do differently? What was the lessons you learned, you know? And that's probably the same question for the other guys, but, you know, what would you have done differently, Tom?
I think having known what we know now, we're certainly thinking about the things we did at Wolverhampton, around medical gases particularly, we would have the information, some of the information we perhaps didn't have before COVID, particularly on capacities and, you know, particular volumes of oxygen we can get into different areas of buildings and restrictions. We know a lot of that information now, so it would have made the initial days of and weeks of COVID a lot easier. So we know where our weak points were, and that's equally on ventilation as well. We've done a massive amount of work through COVID to add resilience and to build better into the systems and to improve what we've got and to get information, because sometimes the information might not have been there that we needed, because we've never seen this before. It was a new game.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. And sort of Claire, now, you know, as we are now, we had a bit of a call last week, didn't we? And I think one of the people on the call mentioned, you know, where I'm from an estates and engineering point of view, you know, we hear a lot about the clinical staff and some of the challenges they've had. But is there an element of COVID fatigue with the staff? And, you know, how do you keep motivating your team to move forward and keep sort of rising to the challenge, really?
That's a good question. Yes, there definitely is COVID fatigue. Staff are definitely, I mean, I think for us particularly, this last wave of COVID was really tough. I mean, we actually, for the first time, we don't have an oxygen VIE system generally, because we can cope on cylinders. I mean, the idea is if any of our patients require a high level of oxygen support, then we would transfer them to acute. But of course, we couldn't this time. The acutes had nowhere, there were nowhere to go. So we had huge oxygen consumption and cylinder consumption, to the point where we were utilising two suppliers. And for our portering staff, having to swap these cylinders around to keep a regular check on flows and that kind of level of content with each of the wards as well, for them particularly, it was really, really demanding. And for the teams as such, I think the only way we've tried to work on staff welfare and look at what we can do to help support. So simple things we've done throughout COVID was free sandwiches, free coffee, tea, water, free fresh fruit baskets to each of our sites. We've also upgraded our staff rooms and put some really nice artwork in there to make it a much more, you know, a much nicer environment to take a break in. But I think the other side of that is trying to get our staff to have annual leave and just take a complete break and switch off, because mm-hmm. unless they can do that, you're exhausted mentally and physically.
No, I think that's a good point. And I heard yesterday, which is a really positive thing, where One Trust was giving their staff an extra couple of days holiday. And they were pleased, but, you know, they were almost, but I can't take the holiday that I've already got. You know, and I'm having to lose some of it because I can't extend it over. I mean, from your point of view, Andy, I must buy some Hawley shares, because you must be really busy at the moment. Are you finding that as a real sort of, you know, particularly with this sector, you know, and I know we've seen this centrally with IE, you know, we're getting more applications for membership now. It's a very buoyant sector, isn't it, really?
Yeah, it is. There's clearly good visibility of investment in the health sector, which should be really encouraging for all of us, I think, shouldn't it? So we all want to build great estates facilities for patients and staff to be healed and to work in. And there's a real drive on some of those large HIP 1, HIP 2 or new hospital program projects that we refer to as now. And we're seeing those are starting to come through and that gives longer term visibility. But we're really, really concerned that there'll be a shift of attention just into the major hospital projects. Actually, what's really critical is the existing estate, the existing infrastructure and helping maintain sort of business as usual within the existing estate. And I think we're still seeing some legacy COVID works and some adaptations into the existing estate. We're seeing some decarbonisation work started to come through and net zero, because that's clearly a big driver. In all of this, it's great net zero sustainability. We're just trying to keep, if we can, that patient-centric voice within all of that. There's a lot of the new hospital programme talks about sustainability, talks about modern methods of construction and talks about digital. We'd just like to see some of that language just switch back to sort of patient-centric sort of outcomes and great places for staff to work in as well, which is absolutely critical for you guys for recruitment and retention in terms of the NHS as well, isn't it? Yeah,
I think, and as I just sort of this sort of recap of where we've been, you know, and I know I was quite flippant about me sitting and watching Netflix, but you know, to sort of echo what Phil said, really, and you three are a sort of a cross section of the, you know, the people who've worked in that sort of eye of the storm. And I know, looking at the attendees, there's a number of people from the NHS and from contracting who have worked in that. So just on behalf of IEM and the West Midlands branches, you know, just a big thank you, really. You know, the work is that you've done is really appreciated. So I wasn't being flippant when I had the luxury of sitting on my sofa eating biscuits. So thank you for that. I think as we move forward, and I think what the, you know, picking up on what Andy said, I think the health sector offers real opportunities. You know, there are other industries and other businesses who sometimes go, you know, that's really niche. You know, we could possibly never work in that because it's all about medical gases. And, you know, the estate of a hospital is quite multifaceted, really. There's offices, there's all sorts of, there's canteen, there's a lot of type of different facilities. So if we look at sort of moving forward and that sort of recovery period or restoring the NHS, I think I sort of read sometimes, where do we see the sort of the lessons, you know, where might this lead? And I'm probably going to come to you, Claire, for this one, is that, how do we sort of, where do we see the balance between acute and community, and, you know, what sort of facilities might, and how might we see that estate changing?
Well, I know with our estate, one of the key things we're looking at for next financial year is installing a medical gas system for our main hospital, primarily because obviously COVID's taught us that we need to be ready. But also it will mean that we can also support the acute with a high level of patient care. And I think, you know, as the ICSs develop and you've got more integrated cares going on between community and acute across that sector, I think that we'll probably see a much more joined up thinking in our patient care pathway and how we approach our, both inpatient and outpatient services.
So do you think there might be a... there may be an opportunity, you know, there might be, you know, as I'm reading the press, there might be a few spare John Lewis stores. But, you know, so, you know, and also Debenham ones, you know, like a BBC, there are other shops available. Do you see us having more sort of diagnostic and facilities? And I think, again, I think you mentioned to me this integrated care system. Do you think we'll see different types of facilities put out into the community?
Yeah, I mean, I know, I mean, from where we are in Birmingham, we're certainly looking at a place-based approach, which will look at the two localities we've got, which is Birmingham and Solihull, with the six, so two place-based, six localities, which is across the north, east, south, west, central and Solihull of Birmingham, and how that aligns with the PCNs as well as the community and what the acute needs. So, you know, diagnostic hubs, I could see very much so being part of that in the community sector, you know, which would mean that you'd have, depending on what they supported, you could then look at a sort of a whole caption of healthcare benefits in what, for that particular neighbourhood area.
Yeah, I think so. And even in the Tom, from your point of view, from, you know, and it's an interesting question. As we are all agile working, you know, if you're office space people, you know, could you see a situation, you know, you know, consultants aren't always going to be there. There's a lot of consultation by Zoom and things like that. And, you know, your office workers, do you see there's going to be a real transformation in how you work, not just the clinical side sort of thing?
I think there could be, I think there's some challenges technically with perhaps Zoom and different applications and trying to, you know, facilitate treatments and consultations. I think it's still very early days in that respect, because people still look at face-to-face, you know, if you've got a condition or you need something looking at. But I think it's very early days, but the shape of, in which we provide the buildings and what we do actually provide, I think will be different, and how perhaps admin areas are facilitated and where they are, definitely should be different and probably will be different going forward. But again, it comes to standards, and there isn't really a standard, so it's a bit like reinventing the wheel in a lot of respects.
Mm-hmm. And Andy, from a sort of an engineering perspective, with all these medical gases and also the Part F, Part F regulations coming in, are we looking at more highly complex engineered solutions and bigger spaces possibly?
Yeah, I think that is the crux of it. I think we were heading in the direction anybody. There won't be too many people in estates and MEP engineering consultancy that will be too disappointed if we get bigger plant rooms. We've been fighting for larger plant rooms for a long time, haven't we? And we're going to get our day by the looks of things. But certainly, as we drive towards net zero technologies, that might lend itself to slightly sort of larger plant rooms in terms of some of the internal and external spaces, if air source is some of the chosen technologies. And then ventilation. Shifting fresh air and air changes trumps pretty much most other technologies, doesn't it, in combating what we've just been through. And we're starting to see those rooms that have always been NAT vents, sort of mental health projects, changing over to mechanically ventilated spaces now as well. And I think that's just a general direction that things are going in. It gives us the comfort and confidence that we need. It is better for the space as well, isn't it? That if we can have the right amount of fresh air. I think what they found was, not only were we in the middle of a pandemic, but some of those facilities, we had one of the hottest years on record in between March and September. For those of us that were working through it was relentlessly hot, wasn't it, for such a sustained period of time. And those, you know, if your bedroom was your sort of area to go to, they were uncomfortable, and it wasn't the right environment to be in either in the middle of a pandemic. And those, some of those hospitals really struggled. So mechanical vent, again, that's additional air handling plant in those plant rooms of some of those facilities, isn't it? So yeah, Mark, it's going to grow. And then the increase on medical gases, and particularly oxygen, which was a key lesson learned. I hope I never see VIE tanks and evaporators the size of the ones at Excel in London ever again in truth. But what it does need is it distributed around the UK, isn't it? Certainly around our hospitals. Yeah.
And I mean, you know, there's been quite a lot of money committed through the HIP projects and stuff like that. But the backlog maintenance in a lot of these hospitals and estates is quite huge, isn't it? One assumes, Claire or Tom picked this one up. It's a little bit political, I suppose, but don't answer too political as we work for the government, is that there's not going to be enough money to put it all right, really, is there? So the solutions are going to have to be reasonably innovative, because there's not enough money to do all the backlog and how do you face that sort of challenge?
I guess, how do you prioritise as well?
Mm.
You know, you've got a lot of, I mean, in, in my career in the hospitals I've worked in, you know, the front house looks fantastic, and then you walk into the plant room, you've gone back in time about 60 years. It's never changed. And on top of that, you've also got huge asbestos issues before you could even get to a lot of the plant. So you've got that cost as well. I mean, I know a lot of the work I did at the trust I was at previously, we had huge asbestos removal costs to do major backlog maintenance works first. And that kind of was a huge percentage of what we were spending. So
wow.
I don't know what the answer is there. The priorities are going to have, how do you prioritise who comes first? What comes first? What's more important? Electrical, heating?
So it's some real challenges. And do you think some of that may be realised by changing the estate and, you know, thinning the estate and selling off surplus land? Or, you know, is there an opportunity for that? Or is that once you sold the, once you sold the family silver, you can't really go back to it, can you, either, you know?
Well, there is a point of landlocking yourself as well. I mean, most hospitals are in the middle of a city, so you are about to landlock yourself quite dramatically if you do sell off your surplus land. But then how do you fund it? It's a really topical situation, I think, that I've always said in some of the hospitals I worked in, I was waiting for a huge catastrophic event to happen, because it was only going to be a matter of time until aspects of the infrastructure was repaired or replaced. And I'm sure there's a lot of my colleagues feel that way now in the places they're working today. So, yeah, it's a really, I mean, having, if I look back on my past experience, I'm sure Tom feels the same. I mean, you've got the heart of the hospital, which is your boiler system and your heating system, but then you've got your nerves, which is all your electricity supplies. And you'd be a message like your brain. So every hospital's got the same problems.
Mm-hmm. Is that something that you used to recognise, Tom, is that you must have some nice show parts, show bits of the hospital to show me, but there must be some stuff at the back that's got the sticking plaster on it?
I think any institution's got a royal route, and the other areas where you close the door on occasionally. But yeah, we've got similar pressures, and it's a continual battle with backlog, and it's continual planning, and it's continual investment. And sometimes, which is a little bit frustrating from my perspective, is when you're going for new builds and new developments to perhaps replace old estates, is sometimes the cost of the architecture defeats the project, because it's too costly, because of the amount of elevated, you know, architecture and fanciness of facilities sometimes makes the cost of it not viable. Whereas simple buildings and simple engineering and simple layouts would perhaps be more cost effective and affordable. But it seems we've gone a different direction in that respect.
That's an interesting one, and that sort of segues it nicely, because, you know, and you're, you know, from what I know, you know, the interaction we've had, some, you're like that engineer's engineer. You know, and you like your engineering, and it's just, and IHEAM are doing a lot about promoting that sort of engineering as a career, and the sort of STEM courses, and we've got a link with Dudley College now, which is going to be really fascinating moving forward. But from your point of view, attracting staff to come into estates departments and engineers, is that a real challenge? You know, you're getting younger people in.
It definitely is a challenge. You tend to see, you know, apprentices tending to like, you know, trades like being an electrician and things like that. But you don't really see people wanting to go in traditional mechanical roles. I think that's going to be a massive pressure for building roles. That's going to be a massive pressure going forward. I think, you know, a big cause of that is the, you know, you don't see kids and you don't see young people messing around with motors on the front of the drives like you used to do, and basic stuff, getting involved in mechanical engineering. You don't see it now at all, and it is a big problem. It's going to be difficult to try and get through as well. I think in some ways we've been lucky with employment from abroad, or perhaps attracting people from abroad to support engineering sectors in the short term, but into the future it's going to be difficult to try and attract people into heavy engineering roles, and certainly with demise of factories as well, because the trades and the apprenticeships aren't there in dirty engineering, if you want to call it that, as what I was involved in when I was an apprentice.
Do you think is the demographic then of a lot of the state's teams, is the demographic quite sort of older characters? We can't say old because that's don't want to be ageist, but is attracting youngsters, is that's a problem, I suppose, yeah?
It is a definite demographics. Certainly my trust for the estates is probably over 50, so it's difficult to get the younger people through. I'm sure Claire's in a similar situation.
Yeah, I mean, we are starting to see some youngsters come through. But what we've been working with IHEAM around the STEM ambassadors kind of project. And my team have been really good in going out to like the local schools and just promoting engineering and hospital engineering. And, you know, the fact that as a hospital engineer, you are multi-skilled. You do know a range of things and you're taught a range of different areas. You know, you don't just sit in engineering. Do you learn a bit of microbiology with Legionella, you know, a bit of accountancy now. So, you know, you do a range of sort of scope within our kind of trade. And I think that's what we're trying to get across is, you know, hospital engineers don't just change light bulbs and unblock toilets.
Yeah. Do you think also with the, you know, with the Internet of Things coming out and that sort of, you know, way forward, you know, it's not all going to be about that sort of heavy engineering. There's a need also for, you know, AI and all that sort of stuff and blockchain. These are words I'm just reading off a list probably. But, you know, it's going to be quite diverse as we move forward. And, you know, one of the things I wanted to sort of, as you are out of our conversation here, you know, from the sort of female perspective, you know, what do we need to do to get more sort of females into our industry? And also, without me clumsily putting this really, because I'm of a demographic where I can really clumsily put this, is how do we get more people from sort of inner city communities who would not necessarily see engineering or a hospital as a career? How do we sort of, how do we promote ourselves better? And
yeah, I mean, it's a difficult one because I got into engineering completely by accident. You know, it wasn't something that I'd originally seen as my career path. And that was purely down to the fact of I wanted to join the Navy, and that's, the engineering was how I ended up going into the Navy. I think, to be honest, if I look back, the sole reason I ended up in the Navy in the first place was because at a very young age, a friend of my sister's had joined as an air engineering mechanic. And it was down to the stories that she told me when she used to come back on leave that made me have that seed in my head. You know, it grew that seed. And when I hit 17, it was like, yes, I'm going to go and join the Navy and travel the world. Didn't know what I was going to do, but that's what I was going to do. And I kind of think that from that, the way that we, both for every youngster, really, we should be introducing engineering at a very sort of primary level in school. You know, just the basic, like the potato clock and that kind of thing. And, you know, and encouraging youngsters through, from a very young age, and showing them what engineering can be, because I think if we're hitting them too late, we you know, they've already got their career path, the ideas of where they want to go, and it's a much more exciting world than. And I do think that we do need to spend more time looking at that school level, primary school and through secondary school, and introducing the concept and setting those little seeds.
Yeah, and it's interesting, Andy, from a sort of from an IHE perspective, and also because, you know, you're in consultancy with this sector. There's so many different roles, isn't there? It's not just about being an engineer. There's accountants, there's people who provide furniture, design furniture, there's marketing people. You know, even in your business, there must be the number of roles are massively multifaceted, aren't they, as such?
Huge, huge, really is. And I'm really interested in what Claire said about joining the Navy and then falling into engineering as a sort of as a byproduct of the career that she'd chosen. Many of us fall into engineering. And when you land in the health sector, you kind of stay there. It's not that you can't find the exit door. It's that you become really, really busy. And actually, it's just something that you really want to stay doing, because it's such a, you know, it's a really good social value part of your own self, really, isn't it? So from that perspective, really good. But I actually think that we're really, really bad, and we should be kicking ourselves more often, because we don't advertise particularly well just how great this particular segment of the industry is, whether we're engineering in estates, engineering in consultancy, or engineering in the construction industry. And if I pull back to that link to the Navy, Claire, I can remember growing up with adverts where join the Navy and you could have been the chef, the engineer, you could have been loading missiles onto the aircraft on that plane. And it was like there was 100 trades on board that boat. There's 100 trades easily here. We employ far more engineers in what we all collectively do. And yet our advertising for joining our industry is really quite minimal, isn't it? And I think that we all collectively have to do a much better job of promoting our industry. And like you say, Claire, we've got to get into those schools and colleges and at a very much earlier stage, haven't we? Yeah, so much to go at.
Yeah, that's a great segue. So sort of just to say that for people who are listening to this, the two of you who are still listening, is that I'm only joking. There might be three. Is that as a committee, we're not a dour bunch. You know, we are looking for more people to join us and more. Younger people, more female, more people from different areas, and you know, we want to attract apprentices. And also what we're looking for is we're looking for ideas for events, something that's somebody might be listening going, well, I don't sell medical gases, I don't do duck work, but as everybody the panel sort of said, is, you know, this is the actual things around a hospital are huge, you know, from a sandwich through to a sewer sewer generator. So, you know, we're really interested in listening and talking to people, and we want people to be engaged with the West Midlands branch of the Institute of Hospital Engineers and Estates Managers. And, you know, hopefully by the sort of panel discussion, you can see that, you know, there are lots of different facets to that. And we would welcome people saying, I'll do a presentation, I'll come on Zoom or Teams and do a presentation for us, because you will really get our support and to move forward. Is that something you all guys can go? It's, you know, we need those ideas, don't we, as such?
Definitely, yeah.
Absolutely.
Definitely, I like it. Yeah, cool. So really, I mean, it's been, we tried to do this as if we were sat in a pub, but there's no alcohol. And I get far more interesting when I've had a drink. You know, we wanted to do it so it was relaxed. Hopefully that's come across. I just want to thank Claire, Andy and Tom for the contribution that you've made to this panel discussion. And thank you for, as I said earlier, about, you know, your eye of the storm, while I was, as you can tell, well, you can't see the rest of my body from me eating biscuits while I was doing that. So, and thank everybody who's on the call for listening. And I'm going to ask Chris Needham to join us, because I think he's going to sort of bring the AGM to a conclusion. Unless, Chris, we've got any specific questions, anybody sort of...
Well, I think, James, if we can open that up to the floor, see if there are any comments or questions or anything from any of our attendees. I find that incredibly resonates with me, clearly, 30 years in the National Health Service. All those things are incredibly familiar to me. But from our attendees, could we? Anybody got any comments or things they'd like to add, or personal experiences?
It's not a problem if people don't.
Everybody's very shy, or they're in the middle of the lunch, and they've got a face full of.
Well, who would want to come on camera? Chris, Phil Wade had the right idea. So I think that's concluded from our point of view. Chris, okay. Thanks to the guys. Thank you. And hopefully people got something out of that. And if you can just sort of do what you need to do now in the formality of it, Chris.
But yeah, thank you very much, everybody. And thanks for everybody's participating in that. I really appreciate it. I found that really insightful, both from a professional, but perhaps more interestingly, from a personal perspective, because it does resonate with me. And I'm actually outside the NHS working with it now, and I felt a tremendous pull back to the NHS. So, you know, there's a lot of very loyal, very capable people in the National Health Service doing what we do, what you guys are doing right now, and you should be applauded for that. So thank you very much for your insights. Thank you for the enthusiasm. It left me with a sense of optimism that there, you know, it is an industry that can grow. I look at things like, technical stuff like pipeline now, from a business sense. There's at least £7 billion worth of investment in the National Health Service in the next sort of 7 to 10 years, notwithstanding £900 million of backlog. That's in addition to all of those things that need to happen. So we've still faced many challenges, but collectively, you know, I'm supporting each other. I'm sure we'll face them just like we did during this last pandemic. So thank you very much for those insights. So I think that all that remains for me to say is thank you very much to everybody on the call. Thanks for joining us. We hope you found it enlightening. We've been through the formalities of the AGM, and we've had this great discussion. And I think at that point, we'll draw it to a close and thank everybody once again. And hopefully we'll see you all at future committee meetings in the coming months. So thank you very much. Bye for now. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Chris.